Can I record it?
Okay. Yeah. A few caveats before I start. We always, in NCSY, when we were teaching the kids Divertoro, we always said, don't start with an apology, but I'm going to start with a few apologies. They always start, my dog ate my Divertoro, I left it at the house. This year has evolved over many years. Some of you have probably heard bits of it before, and maybe initial last week, say. The core ideas are also things that I've thrown in on many different shiurim. I'm well aware that when you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. So if I start talking about lore narrative, say, it just comes naturally. It just, once you have it, you sort of see it everywhere. But I hope to convince you that it's really a very relevant theme in Purim and Megillah. I want to throw in, as I often do, references to modern culture, literature, legal theory, and I hope to convince you also that those are very relevant, so relevant that I really felt like I couldn't leave them out without giving a full picture of what's going on. So this is a book by a very close friend of mine, who was my longtime chavrusa, Barry Scott Wimfheimer. If you have the stomach and zitzfleisch for academic Talmud and critical theory, I highly recommend it. It's very dense, but very excellent. He talks about the relationship between halacha and agada mostly in the Gemara, but more broadly about the relationship between law and narrative in Jewish literature in general and in world literature in general. And one of his most clearest, most concise examples is the Gemara on Megillah Zayin Amud Bet. I guess I'm also going to get a Gemara. Sometimes sing it. Amar Rav Chayiv Ish L'Masube B'Puria Ad Lo Yadven Arham L'Baruch Mordechai. Every Purim, a person must get drunk. On Purim, a person must get drunk until they cannot distinguish between cursed is Haman and Baruch, blessed is Mordechai. This is a sort of strange halacha. Normally, we think of halacha specifically, and law in general, as things that restrict our behavior, that limit what we're supposed to do. Here's a halacha that essentially says, lose control. You have to lose control. Normally we think about law as making very sharp distinctions between asur and mutar, between tameh and tahor, chayav and patur. Here's a halacha that says, lose control until the point where you cannot make any meaningful distinctions between good and bad. To make matters more complicated, the halacha is then followed by a story. The story goes as follows. Rabba and Rabbi Zeira were having Purim Suda together. Rabba got drunk, got up, and killed Rabbi Zeira. He awakens from his inebriated state in the morning, finds Rabbi Zeira dead, prays that he should be resuscitated, and he is, miraculously. Rava, the next year, Rava says to Rabbi Zeira, let's make Purim Suda together again. to which Rabbi Zeira responds, miracles don't happen every day.
Where is that going?
Zayin Amud Bet. Megillah Zayin Amud Bet. The story, like many agadot, seems to run against the general premise of the halacha. If there's a mitzvah to get drunk, well, here's a case where fulfilling the mitzvah leads to some very unforeseen and unfortunate consequences. Luckily, they happen to be Amoraim, and they happen to be able to pull miracles out of their back pocket. But as Rabbi Zeira points out, that doesn't happen all the time. So subversive is the story, in fact, that some of the Rishonim who try to make sense of this Gemara say, well, that's a very nice halacha, but the story undermines the halacha. And most of the Rishonim try to find some middle ground between the story and the halacha, which was a topic that I talked about at a Purim Aliyah a few years ago. What I want to use that Gemara to do is to sort of set up a contrast between my narrative, which I've done in this year many times before, but here we find it in a really very concentrated way. We have a law that seems to be completely antinomian, anti-legal. It seems to undermine the very purpose of law, which is to control behavior and make distinctions. On the other hand, we have a story which not only undermines the law, but also runs against the general trend of stories. Stories are about exceptional circumstances. Well, this is certainly an exceptional circumstance, except that at the end, Rabbi Zera says, you can't rely on things happening exceptionally all the time. Don't assume that the exceptional is going to happen again. The story is sort of anti-story. Therefore, setting up not just one contradiction within the essence of Purim, but sort of a contradiction within each of those contradictory categories. We'll come back to all of that. But when we look at the Megillah, I think it's important to see the Megillah in terms of the categories of law and narrative. Let's start with a very simple observation that the story of Rabba and Rabbi Zera is really, in some sense, an echo of the very first episode in the Megillah. Ahasuerus gets drunk, does something that he regrets upon awaking from his inebriated state, namely getting rid of Vashti, and then he suddenly realizes that he doesn't have a queen and he's got to find a queen. She's not resuscitated. We actually have no idea what happens to Vashti, but whatever it is, it's irrevocable. You already get the sense that there is there are things in the Megillah that spin out of control, that the characters are going to try to control, try to rein in. And we think about the way that they do that. The way that they do that is typically through law. The Megillah is full of laws. Ahasuerus commands Vashti to come, and when he doesn't, he does something, we don't know what. In response, not only does he command Vashti to come and then pass pass judgment on her in some way, but in the process of passing judgment, he passes a law for all of his kingdom, which is Liot kol ish sorer beveito umedabel kilshon amo. Right, everybody should rule in their house over their wives. We see laws again in Perek Gimel, where Haman says you should pass a law that all Jews should be killed. Later on in the Megillah, Mordechai and Esther convince Ahasuerus to have a law that the Jews should be able to defend themselves. And at the end of the Megillah, Mordechai and Esther pass laws about Purim, on and on and on. Everything is a law. The response to everything is legal. Except when you look at these laws more closely, you see, as Ruvain pointed out in at least one case, they're kind of empty. What is Ahasuerus' law after all? It's a law commanding everybody, right? Here's a law that everybody should do exactly what they've been doing all along until now. Everybody should speak their own language. Well, thanks. When Mordechai and Esther passed the law the Jews can defend themselves, what were they going to do before? The laws are essentially codifying the obvious. These are empty laws. These are meaningless laws. It's almost law for the sake of having a law. We need to pass a law, as anybody who's ever been in a committee has felt. It's all about process, and it seems to be no purpose to it. If we contrast that with what we know about law and narrative in, say, Chumash, the contrast is very striking. Because in Chumash, of course, law is very meaningful. Law is about creating a divinely inspired society. Law is that which binds Bnei Yisrael to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Law is the expression of God's will in this world. In the Megillah, of course, we don't have divine law, we have human law. And in some sense, the Megillah serves as a sort of parody of law, right? When you have laws made by people, they're meaningless, they're empty, they're just kind of, again, law for the sake of law. So in that sense, the laws in the Megillah are very similar to the law that we have in the Gemara and Megillah, and that it seems almost paradoxical, a parody of itself. It's a parody of what law is supposed to be.
Laws, Chazal makes laws all
the time. Oh, Chazal do make laws.
They're not empty.
That's true. But in the Megillah, human laws are empty. Okay? In the Megillah, human laws border on meaningless. There's no content. Let's put it that way. But we'll get to Derabanan in a bit. What's the point? Why does Ahasuerus make that first law? What's the impulse to create law? When Ahasuerus's kingdom, it's very clear from that very first law that Ahasuerus's kingdom is what we would refer to nowadays as a multicultural society. Right? He rules over 127 nations. Every nation has its own language. Every nation has its own customs. And the ethos of Persia, at least at this point in Persian history, is to respect local custom, local language, local law. There's no sense in Persia that you have the imposition, as you had, say, in Greece or Rome, or certainly in Greece, of a sort of more of a sort of elitist culture that they were going to impose on all parts of their empire. No, the Persians were very multicultural, as anachronistic as that is. And therefore, there are certain ways in which the Megillah speaks to very modern problems in a way that seems sort of eerily prescient. Because nowadays, of course, we face the same sort of problem. In a modern society, we respect everyone's customs and everyone's right to do what they want and to make meaning from life as they see it, to speak their own language, literally and metaphorically. The problem, of course, is when you live in a multicultural society, how do you keep order? And the answer, the simple answer, is law. What function does law serve in a secular multicultural society? Law is there to maintain order and provide stability when people might otherwise be at each other's throats. And this is straight out of Pirkei Avos. You should respect the reshut, you should respect local non-Jewish authority, because without the local Jewish non-Jewish authority, people would devour each other. That's essentially, that's straight out of Pirkei Avos, obviously a major theme in, say, Thomas Hobbes and a lot of modern political theory. Law is there to maintain order in a multicultural society. I find it fascinating that there's an American legal scholar by the name of Robert Cover who talks about law in exactly these terms. And what he says about law in a modern multicultural society is that you have law, and it's there to maintain order, but it's empty. It has no meaning. Order for the sake of order, but it gives society no meaning, no sense of itself, no sense of its purpose.
But it defines a society.
It doesn't define a society, because we are living together whether we like it or not. That's a fact of existence. It does not create meaning out of that society. It doesn't give the people in society a sense of a higher purpose.
Not a higher purpose. We are because we do the laws.
But why have law? If the purpose of law is to live, then we're stuck in a circular reasoning. The purpose of law is to protect us from each other, and we exist to... the reason we live is to observe the law. Well, if the law is there to make us live and we live to observe the law, then where's the meaning?
Why do you have to add multicultural to the definition?
Why do I have to add multicultural?
There's law in the... monocultural society as well.
There is. We'll talk about that. But I want to talk about law in a multicultural society, because that's what the Megillah is, very clearly, and that's also what most modern societies are. There are very few modern societies that are monocultural. The modern state is almost always multicultural. Even societies that we think about as monocultural, right? Well, maybe there's North Korea,
but
law there. Well, no, there is law there. Oh yeah, right. Virtually every modern state is multicultural. There are very few monocultural societies of any size left. Some are more monocultural than either than others, but anyway. So law does not provide a purpose in that context. Law does not provide a society with a sense of identity. Lost my train of thought for a second. That emptiness, I think, is what animates a lot of the tension in the Megillah. Who or what personifies that emptiness? What's the sort of empty hole at the middle of the Megillah? Throwing it out there to see if any of this is making sense. I'm somebody.
Haman?
Haman. No, not Haman. Haman is very clearly not empty. Haman has a very clear idea of what he wants to do and how he wants to have Ahasuerus. Okay? In what sense is Ahasuerus empty? You'll notice that Ahasuerus is a kind of mysterious character. Chazal already note that there's a debate among Chazal. Was Ahasuerus a wicked king or a foolish king? Well, the text is the fact that we can have that debate means that the text is very ambiguous on that point. And I would go a step further and suggest that the ambiguity is deliberate. We as readers are not supposed to get a clear sense of who Ahasuerus is. Ahasuerus is, in some sense, a blank slate. And that's a very important point in the narrative. It's a very important point in the story, because in some sense, the entire story of Purim is about who will fill that blank slate, who will fill that emptiness in the middle of the Megillah. Ahasuerus is this mysterious character locked away in his palace, locked away behind closed doors. You will notice, by the way, that there's a very interesting parallel between Ahasuerus' palace and, say, the Beis HaMikdash, right, where Ahasuerus is his inner courtyard is a place that you don't go, and if you go, you are threatened with death. There's a mysterious sense of Ahasuerus. We don't know who he is. We don't know quite what he wants. And the tension within the Megillah is who will read meaning into this emptiness at the beginning of the Megillah. What vision of Persian society will dominate? In almost a literal sense, the question is, who will be the real king? Who will fill Ahasuerus's clothes, shoes, and crown? Think about the very center of the Megillah. What happens at the very center of the Megillah? Haman goes to Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus says, what should I do for the person I want to honor? And Haman says, oh, he should wear, thinking of self, he should wear the king's crown and the king's clothes and ride on the king's horse, right? Haman clearly wants to be the king, or at least as close as he can get as possible. And of course, who ends up being the king, who ends up dressing up in the king's clothes and crown and riding a king's horse? Mordechai. That moment, that decisive moment, is the moment, of course, at which everything changes. But up until that point, it's not clear who's going to prevail. Haman and Mordechai, the struggle between Haman and Mordechai is really a struggle over this vision of a multicultural society. Who will provide meaning at the very center of this multicultural society? Haman's vision, of course, is a very disturbing and very scary vision. But it represents a very distinct trend in modern liberal society. Here's where the literature comes in. There's a fascinating story, one of the sort of iconic short stories of American literature. It's a story by called The Lottery by Shirley Jackson. Anybody read it? No, yeah. Spoiler alert, it's a really great story, and if you haven't read it and you want to read it without knowing the end, just go out and I'll call you back in. I read it in high school. It's one of these classic stories that you read in high school, and you're like, it's a very short story, but it takes your breath away. It's set in an anonymous town somewhere in, I mean, it's America, but it could be anywhere. The townspeople gather in the town square on a summer day. And every family in the town has to draw a lot. And then, after everybody has drawn lots, every head of every father, every head of household draws a lot, and then they all open their lots, and one person's lot has a black dot on it. And then every member of that family goes and draws another lot, and one member of that family's lot has the black dot on it, and that person is killed by the rest of the town. And throughout the story, there's mention of the fact that the lottery is something they do every single year, and apparently lots of towns do it, and some towns are starting not to do it, and they're very critical of the fact that some towns are starting not to do this lottery. It's so sacred, it's such an ancient custom. What is that about? It's a very spooky story, and part of the reason it's such an iconic story is because it fits our, you know, certain very basic notions of what a short story should be. Short, tight, and there's that like twist at the end. There's also something very fundamental that the story represents about a certain impulse in human society in general, and I think it's especially prevalent in a multicultural society, which is when there's an emptiness in the middle of society, when you have a society that has no meaning, society creates meaning by having scapegoats. It was a fascinating little historical detail that I picked up when I was looking back at the story. The story generated a lot of controversy. It was published in the New Yorker, and the New Yorker got a ton of negative. It's easily the most controversial story the New Yorker has ever published. It was banned in South Africa. And Shirley Jackson was actually very, she said, of all of the negative responses that she got, she felt that was the best because she said they understood the story. The message of the story is, of course, that sometimes in order to have perfect society, you sacrifice a certain segment of society as outcasts.
That's why I didn't read the story.
Right, that's you, yes.
What year was this written?
Sorry?
What year was this written?
1948. There is that impulse to exclude a certain segment of society. We see it, of course, in Nazi Germany. We see it all over the world. That, in some sense, creating a perfect society requires certain members of that society to be outcasts. It's another fascinating story. To have an outcast, yes, fair enough. On that note, there's another story by a writer named Ursula Le Guin, a very famous science fiction writer, called The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas, about this kind of perfect idyllic society. And what allows this idyllic society to exist is there's one child who's taken at a very young age and locked in a room where they're tortured and beaten and starved. And at some point, the way Le Guin tells the story, there's some point in that society, upon a coming of age, every person in that society is made aware of that child. They have to go and they have to see the child and be aware. And at that point, they can become an adult in that society. That's the price of living in such an idyllic society. And the end of the story is there are those who walk away from Amelas who refuse to make that bargain. And Le Guin throws in, she's in some ways a very annoying writer, in some ways a very perceptive writer. This happens to be one of my favorite stories by her. And she says, the ones who walk away from Omelas go somewhere, I don't know where, but she kind of leaves it at that. She says, I don't know where they go. Haman's ethos is exactly that ethos. In order for a multicultural society to exist and have some sort of meaning at its core, sometimes the meaning that you give to life, what justifies or gives meaning or gives significance to your life, is that you are not that person. You define yourself as the opposite of someone else. You define yourself as alive by the fact that you are not the one to be sacrificed. Nachon. Yesh lanu amalek. That's true, and that's... Yes, I'm sorry you mentioned that. Hold that thought. Every time you show that shayla tachi kashrut. The reason that I find the lottery to be such a compelling parallel is, of course, that Haman also doesn't choose Bnei Yisrael by lottery, but he chooses when they will be destroyed by lottery. I just find that to be such a striking parallel between Megillah and the story. Why lottery? Why is the notion of chance significant? Because in some sense, what is Haman and this society in Shirley Jackson's story trying to do? They're recognizing the meaninglessness of life, the arbitrariness of life, the fact that there is no meaning at the core of life, and they're trying to harness it. They're trying to say, we will cast the lots, we will take chance into our own hands, and somehow allow that arbitrariness to determine who we will sacrifice and how we will sacrifice them. What's the alternative? Where do the people who walk away from Omelas go? The alternative in the Megillah is obviously Mordechai. And this, by the way, a lot of this, some of this notion of multiculturalism comes from this this pamphlet that I found. I'll pass it around. I picked this up, it must be close to 20 years ago in Yeshiva. I've been looking for it ever since. I found it in the Bar Ilan library, and it didn't say half of the things that I remembered it saying. So I have to read it through again. But it does talk a lot about multiculturalism and pluralism and the two different approaches and actually talks about, he ties Haman into Haman as human and Haman as denying God and Hamin Ha'etz, some of the things that Ruben talked about a few minutes ago. Excellent book, you can order it online, it's 20 shekel, but really a very worthwhile read by Rav Yonatan Blass. So a lot of this is taken from Rav Blass. Rav Blass's answer about Mordechai is that, well, what's the alternative? What gives meaning to society, as a contrast to Haman? God, right? Belief in God. That's obviously true, but I feel a little too pat. First of all, what does it mean for God to fill that hole? Is it simply enough to have belief? What belief in what? And also, it doesn't seem to me to fit the Megillah quite right, because of course in the Megillah, as much as we want to see God in the Megillah, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not explicitly mentioned, and the question of course is why. So I wanted to develop a slightly more complicated notion of Mordechai's alternative to Haman's vision for this pluralistic multicultural society. When Robert Cover talks about meaning, law giving meaning in a multicultural society, as I said, he's very aware that the authority, the overarching authority, the American government, in his case, is not able to provide meaning through law. Law provides order, provides stability, but ultimately, in terms of giving society a sense of identity, it's empty. There are, however, within American society, individual groups who provide meaning in their own way. And they do it, says Cover, through a sense of narrative. Groups that provide meaning always have a shared narrative. For African Americans, for example, the narrative that binds them as a group is their history as slaves, and then the abolitionist movement, the Civil War, eventually the Civil Rights movement. He talks about the Amish. The Amish, who are these, if you don't know, they're a sect of Christians who live in Pennsylvania and Iowa and Ohio, who still live without a lot of modern technology, without electricity. They are descended from a Christian sect that was founded about 400 years ago, the Anabaptists, and they were persecuted, and they came to America for religious freedom. That's their story. That's the narrative that binds them together. In these societies, we'll hold that thought. Where is narrative in the Megillah? If Haman and Ahasuerus represent the forces of man-made law, these kinds of empty, meaningless laws that are there to provide order, or in Haman's case, to find a scapegoat that will somehow bind the rest of Persian society together, the antidote to that is narrative. Here's another sort of layer of significance. If nothing else here resonates with you, take this away. One of the central themes in the Megillah is tension between masculine and feminine. And that's from the very beginning of the Megillah. Ahasuerus commands Vashti to come forward. Vashti refuses. it's very clear in the Megillah there's an elemental tension there, not just between Vashti and Achashverosh as individuals, but between men and women. Because what's the law that Achashverosh passes? Or why does Achashverosh pass a law? Memuchan says to him, look, if you don't do anything, if Vashti refuses, then every wife will rebel against her husband. Right? So Achashverosh's law is to head that off at the pass. There's a sense that the men in the Megillah, at least in the case of Haman and Achashverosh, are very nervous about, or very anxious to control their women.
So is that a meaningless law, meaning that the men are already controlling them?
Yes, because it's meaningless in the sense that it's just about creating order, right? It's about, it's an anxiety about chaos. Somehow, Vashti's violation of the law, right? Why is Achashverosh nervous? There's a certain social order. That's how things are. He rules over Vashti, and if she refuses to come before him, that undermines his control. Achashverosh and even Haman are like the archetypal glass egos, right? They can't withstand any challenge to their authority, any uncertainty, and any self-doubt. They're impulsive, right? Everything has to be resolved now, right? Haman has to go to Achashverosh in the middle of the night just to make sure they can't even wait for the next morning. Achashverosh has to do something about Vashti now. They're typical glass egos. They cannot withstand anything, and they can't even control their emotions. All of their emotions are out in the open. They're angry. They're frustrated. The women in the Megillah, by contrast, are very controlled, very withdrawn. Vashti refuses to come before Achashverosh. Esther refuses to identify herself, refuses to say who she is or where she's from or what nation she's from. She refuses, both Vashti and Esther refuse to identify their motives, not only to the people they are dealing with, but even to the readers of the Megillah. We don't actually know why Vashti doesn't come forward. The Medrash obviously gives us several reasons. We don't even know, by the end of the story, why Esther tells Achashverosh to come to one party and then another party, right? How does that solve the problem? We don't know. The women, if the men are the ones who create laws, because they're anxious, because they're trying to be in control, because they're afraid of this anarchy and chaos and everything spinning out of control, the women are very sure of themselves. They're very withdrawn. They don't need to broadcast their emotions or their intentions. And they're also the ones to repeatedly violate the law. Vashti refuses to come before Achashverosh. Esther goes before the king, even though it means almost certain death. And at least in Esther's case, she gets away with it. They don't play by the rules, and they don't need to create more rules in order to have a sense of self. In that sense, they are anti-legal, and they're the ones, critically, Esther especially, is the one who moves the plot of the story forward. And ultimately, it's the plot that Esther sets into motion that ends up saving Bnei Yisrael. Esther represents the force of narrative within the Megillah. If the laws are the things that create the problems, Esther's plot, the narrative that she sets into motion, ends up being the solution. If the laws in the Megillah are human laws, and they're almost a parody of what law should be, the narrative in the Megillah, any sophisticated reader realizes, the narrative is a divine narrative. Where is HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the Megillah? HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the one working behind the scenes, manipulating all these coincidences to end up saving Bnei Yisrael. The narrative is the thing that ends up winning out in the Megillah, and the narrative is the key to what happens at the end of the Megillah, which is Mordechai and Esther's creation of Purim. Mordechai and Esther also create a law, but in this case, the law is different than the ones that we find at the beginning. The law is not empty. What do the laws at the end of the Megillah do? They commemorate this narrative. The laws are there, the laws of Purim are there, and we're told over and over and over again, to make sure that the memory of Purim will never be lost. Robert Cover talks about law in exactly the same way when he's talking about these self-enclosed, self-contained societies, these monocultural societies. Why do the Amish have laws? Why do they have these very strict laws about their community and what to technology they're allowed to use, what they're not allowed to use. They have laws to prevent, to preserve their sense of self, a sense of self that is rooted in their communal narrative. And what's fascinating is the cover talks about this this notion of narrative as the basis for communal identity. The cover was Jewish, and the perfect example of a narrative, a sort of national narrative that creates a sense of identity is Jewish history, right? Why do we have Pesach? Pesach is there to remind us year in, year out of Yetzias Mitzrayim, and then we have Shavuos to remind us of Mamad Har Sinai. These are the pivotal moments of Jewish history. They only last for a moment in time, but the law is there to perpetuate it through time and make sure that identity is not lost. Purim is the very first time in Jewish history that we have a human law, that's what Derabanan, that's meant to serve exactly the same purpose. Right? And that's that sense, of course, that when Chazal talk about Purim as the acceptance of the Torah, well, what does that mean? In one sense, what it means is that now Chazal are doing exactly what HaKadosh Baruch Hu did. How do you preserve a sense of identity after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash? You take a pivotal, nationally defining event and you pass laws so that the memory of that event will never be forgotten. And of course, the narrative of Purim becomes the template for the narrative of much of the rest of Jewish history following the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash and then the second Beis HaMikdash. What is the narrative of Jewish history without a central national institution like the Beis HaMikdash? We've been subjects of another country. Occasionally we've tried to destroy it. They've tried to take our identity away from us, or they tried to kill us, and we've survived. Right? That's what defines us. That's what defines us as a nation. And we send gifts of food to each other, and we're playing endless games of Gamad Vanak in school, right? That's what defines us. I was in the supermarket last night for the second time buying more stuff for Gamad Vanak, and I saw another father there, and I said, this is ridiculous. He said, yep.
It's interesting that the Goral falls out of a month, which is Gemara.
Okay. As much design as there is, as much as there is a plan, as much as the law is there to preserve something and make it a part of history. An essential part of the law is preserving the narrative essence of Purim. What is the narrative essence of Purim? If law is about rigidity and control, narrative is about never knowing what's going to happen, right? And if there's any one character in the Megillah who kind of straddles the masculine and feminine sides of this, it's Mordechai. What does Mordechai say when he's telling Esther she's got to go do this? Who knows, he says. We never know. We never really know. We never know how anything is going to happen. We never know how the narrative is going to unfold. Narrative in the future is a mystery. We can never know the future for sure. And even in the name of Purim, right, we do not try to strip away that arbitrariness. In fact, we preserve it in the very name. Haman sees arbitrariness as an essential feature of nature. Right? There's nothing controlling the world. Everything is fate. Everything is random. Nothing is fate. We, on the other hand, take the name of Purim, the arbitrariness of history, and infuse it with meaning. It seems arbitrary to us, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu, of course, is acting behind the scenes. He's the one who caused a lot to land on that day. He's the one who causes all the coincidences that lead to the redemption. To us, it seems random, and that randomness is important because we're not in control. It's only HaKadosh Baruch Hu who's in control. When we preserve the memory of that narrative, we understand there's a hand behind it. It's fascinating. One of the most puzzling moments of the Megillah for me is when Haman goes back after leading Mordechai from the streets, and he tells his family what's happened, and then they say, oh, he's Jewish. Why didn't you say so? Right? It's at that moment they confirm what we know, which is that even though everything seems random, right, and we don't know how the story is going to unfold, we know that there's going to be a happy ending, right? That's when they confirm, they say, well, you've lost. We don't know how you're going to lose, but you're going to lose. So just to bring back to the Gemara, when we talk about, when we think about Purim, there's this unavoidable tension. The Gemara, one of the reasons I like that Gemara is not only is it a perfect example of the tension between law and Arab in general, But it really captures the essence of what Purim is about. There's no day on the calendar that we walk such a fine line between two total such polar opposites. We are, on the one hand, concerned with the absolute meticulous observance of every halacha of Purim, some of which Rav Elizabeth tells about. But we sit there in shul in rapt attention, making sure we don't miss a syllable of the Megillah. And yet, it's a day. It's the day on the Jewish calendar when we act in some ways with complete and total abandon. The notion that somebody should be reading the Megillah while dressed in reading a syllable dressed up in this ridiculous costume. Well, that just captures what Purim is about. There's this diametrically opposed, these two diametrically opposed forces that come head to head on this one day of the calendar. I find Purim to be one of the most exhausting days on the Jewish calendar. More exhausting than Yom Kippur, more exhausting. It just you by the end of the day you're just like, well, you know, did I fulfill the mitzvahs? Did I get drunk enough? Did I get drunk enough to fulfill the mitzvah, which again feels like such a contradiction in terms. That's important, and that tension is important because it captures so much of what Purim is about. On the one hand, the recognition that so much of Jewish history is out of our control. So much of Jewish history is about trusting in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that He has a plan, and that He will in fact protect us, even though we can never see the future. And on the other hand, making sure that our national identity is expressing that sense through the laws that we that are created at the end of the Megillah. Because of course, without the laws, we're destined to repeat the same mistakes over and over and over again. So when we have laws and we have that sense of national identity, that we can realize and read through the lines of history and see that it's in fact HaKadosh Baruch Hu protecting us in every generation. Yeah. Yeah.